Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jonathan Curiel and I'll be moderating tonight's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Reza Aslan, an internationally acclaimed writer and scholar of religions. He's a fellow at the University of Southern California's Center on Public Diplomacy and a Middle East analyst for CBS News. Reza has degrees in religions from Santa Clara University, Harvard University, and the University of California, Santa Barbara, as well as a Master of Fine Arts from the University of Iowa. Reza Aslan's first book is the New York Times bestselling No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, and it's been translated into 13 languages, also shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award in the UK, and nominated for a Penn USA Award for Research Nonfiction. His latest book, How to Win a Cosmic War, was published by Random House in April. Reza is co-founder and creative director of Boom Gen Studios, a hub for creative content from and about the Middle East, as well as editorial executive of Mecca.com, an online community for Muslim youth. Born in Haran, he now lives in Los Angeles, where he is assistant professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. Please welcome Reza Aslan. Now, Reza, you've written widely about Islam and the Middle East and so forth, but I'd like to begin our conversation this way. Tonight in Washington, President Obama is having an iftar dinner celebrating Ramadan, and he's invited a select group of Muslim Americans as well as non-Muslims. Now, Mr. Obama, during his campaign, his father, of course, was Muslim. In a sense, a lot of Muslims were disappointed that he distanced himself from his Islamic background, and yet, as soon as he became president, he embraced that, it seemed, in public. What does President Obama's election and his sitting in the White House, what does that say about the state of Muslim Americans, Islam in America, and any other subject you might wish to address?
Well, all right, that's a good start. I suppose it is significant to have a secret Muslim in the White House, certainly. And so that means something, I'm sure. I think the election of Barack Obama has a lot more to do with the nature of the demographic shifts that are taking place in the United States, as the Census Department has noted. We are fast approaching a period in which we will be a majority-minority country, which, as far as I know, I don't think any nation state can boast of, certainly not in modern history. And so, in a sense, there is something very unique about the election of Obama because it represents where the nation is going as a whole. I think that his background and the fact that he did have a Muslim father had to have been, in one way or another, I think, diminished during the campaign, because the fact of the matter is that the United States, for all of its pride in its diversity and the history of immigration that we have in this country and the melting pot status that we wear on our sleeves, is still a country that is still very nervous about other religions, certainly, other cultures, ethnicities, in particular Islam. Just about a year ago, the Washington Post, ABC News, released a poll that showed that 50% of Americans still hold negative views about Islam. About a third of Americans believe that there is essentially no such thing as a moderate Muslim, that Islam equals violence, fundamentalism, terrorism. What was really shocking about this poll is that it had essentially been unchanged since 2002, the first time that the Washington Post conducted a similar survey. So in a sense, it seems as though opinions about Islam and about Muslims haven't changed all that much in this country. And there were some very interesting, embarrassing moments during the campaign in which Obama was forced to distance himself, as you say, from his Muslim roots. But I think that now that he's president and the mandate that put him into that office has given them the freedom to, I think, be a little bit more expressive of it, certainly when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, you go back to the historic speech in Cairo, the so-called address to the Muslim world. in which he spent a good deal of time talking about his biography and the fact that he has used that biography deliberately to push back against the attacks from jihadist ideologues like Osama bin Laden or Ayman Zawahiri. He can say with confidence that his father was a Muslim. He has Muslims in his family. He spent a significant time in a Muslim household. He knows what Islam is. He's no longer going to be trapped by that same religiously polarizing rhetoric that the Bush administration used to such effect. And that, in some ways, has really silenced the ideologues, the jihadist ideologues. They don't know how to respond to an American president named Barack Hussein Obama.
Right. And in fact, the Muslim world has embraced his presidency, maybe even reluctantly, because the subject of Israel-Palestine always comes up, and a lot of Muslims say, well, he may be this, but then what about that? But can you talk about the fact that around the world, Muslims look at the United States differently, and if indeed Muslim Americans look at themselves differently with someone like Barack Hussein Obama in the White House?
They certainly look at the United States differently. I was in Turkey when Obama visited the Turkish parliament, and he made a historic address where he talked about the Turkish-American relations and really tried to create a new narrative of the framework of relations between the United States and the so-called Muslim world. I'll just keep saying so-called in that because there's really no such thing as the Muslim world. I don't really know what that phrase means. But the point, I think, however, is that it's also reframed the perceptions that Muslims around the world have not just about America and American foreign policy and American government, et cetera, but about American Muslims. The fact of the matter is that Muslims in the United States live very privileged lives. There are about 8 million Muslims in America, according to the State Department. It's the largest non-Christian religion in the United States. It's one of the fastest-growing religions in America. It's also an incredibly wealthy community. About 60% of Muslims in the United States own their own homes. The median income for a Muslim household in America is larger than for a non-Muslim household. Enormous literacy rates, very high education rates. And so, in a sense, I think it's the socio-political status of Muslims in the United States, not so much their religion, but their landscape, the context in which they live, that has in some ways alienated them, especially from their core religionists in the Middle East, which tend to be a bit poorer, tend to live in not as advantageous situations, and most especially with their core religionists in Europe, who tend to deal with a much less inviting, much more Islamophobic landscape than we see even here in the United States.
Right, and although even here in the United States there are, you could call them extremists, call them whatever, who say that Islam in America is almost people need to be on guard against Muslims in America. These are people who, of course, traffic in threatening ideas anyway. But it seems like they're trying to paint all Muslims with one broad brushstroke. And I don't know whether it's working or not. The polls you're indicating at the outset, talking about a number of Americans don't really see Islam as a peaceful religion. Maybe it is working in that sense. I mean, why are those numbers stable in that way?
Well, I'll tell you what. Another thing that the poll indicated is that about 60% of Americans claim that they've never actually met a Muslim, which I find hard to believe because, I mean, have you ever been to a doctor? But chances are he's a Muslim. I don't know if they think that, all Muslims wear turbans or something. I don't really understand that. But what it did indicate is that of those who know at least one Muslim, their impression of Islam was drastically improved. So in a way, I think that what these polls indicate is not so much about Americans' impressions about Islam or about Muslims, but it's sort of a part and parcel of a larger problem of identity that Americans face. We are not a country in which ethnicity and nationality mean the same thing. There is no such thing as an ethnic American, or, well, there were, but we managed to massacre most of them. The fact of the matter is that in the United States, our identity is quite often throughout our history formed in direct opposition to an other. And that other constantly changes. You know, in the 19th century, it was Catholics. We passed federal laws in this country stripping Catholics of their human rights. In the 20th century, it was Jews. You know, they looked different. They prayed different. They seemed like they weren't Americans. But certainly no one in the 21st century would hold those views. I mean, certainly nobody in their right mind would hold such views about Catholics and Jews. And I think that Muslims just tend to be the sort of, you know, the new other, if you will. And I think that's going to change too, and it's going to be a generational shift. I think that the first real massive wave of Muslim immigrants into this country in the 1950s and 60s, let's be clear for a moment, the first wave of Muslim immigrants in this country were slaves. They were brought here on slave ships. They were predominantly Muslims from Africa. But in the 20th century, the sort of first major wave of Muslim immigrants in the 50s and 60s, they came primarily from countries in which political participation wasn't actually a reality. I'll tell you just a quick sort of personal story. I remember after September 11th, I went back to visit my parents, who are not by any means pious Muslims, and not all that patriotic, to be frank. But when I drove up to my parents' house, it was covered in American flags. And I walked in and I said, "What's with the flags everywhere?" And my mother said to me, "They're watching." My mother, who came from Iran, in which they are watching. And I think that the children of those immigrants... I wasn't born here in the United States, but those who were born here in the United States and who have thoroughly absorbed the ideals of America and have reconciled their Islamic identity with their American identity, they are going to start making certain demands, and they have certain expectations of this country that their parents didn't have. They're going to be much more politically active, socially active. They are going to make the demands that their economic prowess allows them to make of this country. And I guarantee you that 50 years from now, we're not going to think about Islam in the same way or Muslims in the same way. But don't worry, we'll find some other scapegoat by then. So.
A reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Reza Aslan about Islamic identity in the United States. If you do a Google on Muslims in America, as I did earlier today, and maybe that was a mistake, but if you do a Google on that, you find something said, the headline was, "Can Muslims be American?" And "Who are they really?" was the subhead. And I thought, wait a minute, oh, this is one of these hate websites. But if you go to it, it's actually profiles. It's called MuslimIndex.org, and it's profiles of well-known people who happen to be Muslim. For example, Shaquille O'Neal, I had no idea the NBA player is Muslim. Hakeem Olajuwon, of course, and others.
Michael Jackson, let's not forget Michael.
Michael Jackson, exactly. Although that's open to debate. open to debate. But this is a theme, and again, you're talking about how 50 years from now, this won't really people won't even care about such things. But now people do, and a lot of Muslims will say, "Look, we have been here, we are here. Here are people just like us who you embrace, yet you may not realize they are Muslim." Have you encountered that? Is that something that's, I mean, it's certainly not unique to the Muslim American community.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, I was watching in the various documentaries and news programs about Senator Ted Kennedy's passing. Of course, we've been watching a lot about, you know, the Kennedy family. And you recall that it was not barely 50 years ago in which the arguments about Kennedy being president was that his loyalty could not be to the United States. His loyalty must be to Rome as a Catholic. Now, we look at those documentaries and we laugh at that thought. It's ridiculous. And I think we'll look back at this time with the same attitude. In a sense, really, this isn't about Islam. It's about America. What does it mean to be American? Is it acceptance of a set of political principles? Is it a citizenship test? You know, what is it? I mean, is there some sort of immigrational primacy that you get? The thing about American identity is that it's always been so malleable. This is the positive and the negative aspect of it, the good and the bad, is that it's so malleable, so infinitely hyphenable, that it can be whatever you want it to mean. But that, of course, threatens some people. And I think that, in a sense, we have to see the way that a lot of this fear of Islam in the United States is expressed as part and parcel of the larger issues of identity formation that have always been a part of the American cultural fabric.
Now, I've written about American Muslims before, and I was in one of my articles, I interviewed a lot of women who say, and these are converts to Islam, who say that as an American woman, they prefer the Islamic way of looking at the world, and even to the point of dressing. You know, the way the conservative or religiously oriented Muslim women wear hijab, for example, and so on. A question from the audience is, how does an American Muslim explain the oppression of women in Islam? And I know that there's a perception of that, certainly. And within the American Muslim community, that you hear arguments both for and against that idea.
Yes, I hear this a lot. In fact, I overheard a conversation actually the last time that I was in Iran in which an American asked an Iranian, why do you force women to wear a headscarf to go out onto the streets? And the Iranian asked the American, why does it take a half-naked woman to sell power tools in your country? You know, the thing about the veil is that it has always been a symbol, but it's what it actually stands for has shifted, of course, depending on cultural context and time. For the British colonialists in India and Egypt, the veil was a symbol of Islam's backwardness. And so they fought against it, certainly not because they wanted to empower women. On the contrary, it's because they thought that it would be the sort of the impression of Western culture to allow women to dress how they want. What was interesting is that during those time there were no veil laws. In fact, the surge in women wearing veil, particularly in the Middle East, occurred in direct response to the colonial attempts to westernize these countries. As a man, it's hard for me to talk about these issues because I'm of the opinion that the veil means whatever a woman who's wearing a veil wants it to mean. For some, it's a symbol of oppression. For some, it's a symbol of feminism. For some, it's a symbol of the West. For some, it's a symbol of the East. But we do have to recognize that, there are countries in the world, particularly in the Middle East, in which women do not have the same legal or social rights as men, and that in many cases this is about as much about ethnicity and tribe and local culture as it is about religion, in a sense this is as much a problem of economic and social development as it is about cultural and religious issues. But we have to, I think, be wary of making blanket statements about what a woman chooses to wear. In the New York Times today, there was an article about France's attempts to ban the niqab, that covers the entire face except for the eyes, and which 0.1% of Muslims in France wear. I'm not sure what the need is to actually go through a legislative attempt, to actually ban something that 0.1% of women wear. But it's not about the veil. It's about cultural ideas about identity. It's about France trying to say that we are something and what we are is not this. So I think we should just sort of step back for a moment. There's a real genuine discussion that needs to be had about women's rights in some majority Muslim countries, particularly in the Middle East. But nevertheless, we have to be careful about, you know, making certain generalizations and objectifying women by sort of assuming that because you choose to put a piece of cloth over your head, then you are oppressed in some sense.
Right, and a lot of Muslim women have told me that this veiling, as it were, this covering the hair, of course, is not unique to Islam. You'll find it in Judaism and Christianity. But let me ask you this: you're talking about the attempt to ban the niqab in France. In this country, in Oklahoma, there's been an attempt to ban the hijab in driver's license photos. And also, I noticed that in Oregon, a law is set to take effect in January that bans religious garb, teachers in public schools from wearing religious garb, which means, you know, Muslim women who wear hijab cannot wear that.
That's all it means. This is how France got away with it as well. They said, well, but we're not just banning the veil. We're banning all conspicuous religious garb. Not sure what they actually mean by that, because most Christians I know don't wear life-size crosses around their necks. You put a cross into your shirt. The issue here is I think that there is this sort of fear of otherness again that I have to go back to over and over again. We in the United States, however, find what's going on in Europe as kind of odd. I mean, you could be completely racist in the United States. You could, want all immigration to stop, and you may see Muslims as demonic enemies. But if you were asked, should the government force you to wear or not wear certain clothing, you would be appalled by such a thing. And yet, this is precisely what's taking place in Europe. There's a real difference in the way that we think about personal freedoms and the rights of the government to impinge on those freedoms in the name of cultural identity, and certainly in the way that you see in the UK and in France.
We're going to take another question from the audience. It's, do you have any suggestions for building bridges of understanding among Muslims, Christians, Jews, and members of other faith communities? And I know that's a very, big question to ask, but can you answer that?
It's happening in the United States. We are, without question, the most religiously diverse nation in the history of the world. We have no choice but to live with each other and to absorb other cultures, other ideals. People ask me all the time, what is the difference between Islam in the U.S. and Islam in Europe? And there are a whole host of issues that have to be brought to bear. Certainly economics plays a role, when I've mentioned that in some sense. Issues of identity play a role as well. Many countries in Europe are having a very difficult time constructing an identity that is not based around a sense of cultural or ethnic homogeneity that just simply doesn't exist anymore. Whereas in the United States, we've never had ethnic or cultural homogeneity, and so we've never dealt with that kind of challenge. But I would say the principal difference between Muslim life in America and Muslim life in Europe is that in the United States, we believe that religion is a positive thing, that it should play some role in society. It shouldn't infringe on people who don't hold religious faith, but it certainly shouldn't be excised from the public realm either. And so, in a sense, we're comfortable with displays of religiosity. We may look at a Muslim praying, it may look odd to us. It may look unfamiliar, the yogic postures, the unfamiliar utterings, but we still recognize it and, in fact, value it as prayer. And so, in a sense, it's that common sense that religion is powerful, it can be positive, it does have a role in society that allows for the building of bridges between various religious communities in the United States in a way that you don't see anywhere else in the world. It also creates, I think, an enormous responsibility because, frankly, if Americans can't figure out a way for interreligious dialogue, interreligious pluralism, and interreligious action, then we're really screwed as a world because it's not going to happen anywhere else. So if it doesn't happen here, it won't happen anywhere else.
Segues into our next question from the audience, and that's, can American Muslims influence the spread of democracy in the Middle East? And a kind of second question is, how do you explain electoral popularity of extremist groups in the Middle East? two questions, but the first one, you know, can American Muslims influence the spread of democracy? And that's a question you could ask of a lot of politicians, non-Muslim or Muslim, and they might have difficulty.
Well, I think that they are influencing it already, and they're influencing it in a very important sense, because the new communication technologies, the internet, satellite, television, has allowed for a level of person-to-person contact between Muslims in the United States and Muslims around the world that would have been unimaginable even a decade ago. And more importantly, I think Muslims around the world, particularly in the Middle East and in the larger Arab world, are by no means isolated. They know what's going on around them. They see the lives of American Muslims, and they want it. They make it very clear that political participation, political freedom, democracy are issues that they believe will work in their societies. They believe that there's no fundamental clash between ideas of Islam and ideas of democracy. These are massive majorities that every single poll have shown that they want democracy in their own countries. They don't see that as a real problem. I think it's also important to recognize that a third of the Muslim world is already democratic. The largest Muslim country in the world, Indonesia, is a democracy. The second largest Muslim country in the world, Turkey, is a democracy. India, which is, believe it or not, the third largest Muslim country in the world, even though Muslims are a small minority of that country, democracy. Pakistan is a democracy. Malaysia is a democracy. Senegal is a democracy. Bangladesh is a democracy. So let's retire this notion that Islam and democracy can't work because a simple Google search will show that that's incorrect. In the larger sense, this idea of why is it that these sort of extremist groups in certain countries are becoming successful in certain elections. I say certain countries because it's important to note that, for instance, in Indonesia's recent election, the so-called Islamists were soundly defeated, as we saw in Pakistan's recent elections, in which the Islamist parties, despite the fact that they actually banded together to create one almost super party, did very, very poorly, didn't get above 5% of the vote. I think what you're referring to is countries like Egypt, places like Palestine, places like Lebanon, in which those groups who, despite half a century of having no avenue for political participation whatsoever, were suddenly given an opportunity to participate in the political realm, to actually run for elections, did exceedingly well. Of course they did exceeding. Who was surprised by this? I want to find the person who was surprised that Hamas did well in the 2006 elections in Palestine, or that the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been feeding and clothing poor people for half a century in Egypt, which has built schools and hospitals, and has provided educational grants for Egyptians to go abroad and study. Who thought that when they were first allowed to run for office that they weren't going to do well? Who thought this? This has nothing to do with what we would consider to be extremism. It has to do with the universal law of politics. He who cleans the streets gets the votes. The end.
Reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Reza Aslan about Islamic identity in America. You know, you talk about Egypt and in North Africa in your book, No God But God. You begin by recounting this train trip you took to, I believe it's Marrakesh, right? Mm-hmm. And I won't go into too many details, but needless to say, it was the middle of the night, and there was a commotion next door. An American couple was being essentially told, stop what you're doing, by the conductor. And you had never heard such screaming, if I can put it that way, in your life, certainly on a train. And it was shocking to realize this American couple were evangelizers on their way to southern Morocco to sort of preach the gospel. And you were kind of caught in between, on the one hand, this angry conductor, and on the other hand, this seemingly sweet American couple who was actually evangelizing and who knows what in the cabin. I mean, it was unclear. Yes. It was unclear what was happening there, which is why it was a really great introduction, by the way. I mean, there's no surprise your book is a bestseller. I mean, it's not just because of the introduction, but... But you've been a first-hand witness to this idea, this perception that there is this kind of clash of cultures, civilizations, as it were. And a lot of people, you included, say there is no such clash. But can you talk about this idea that there is the perception of one, and that in a way this colors the perception of Muslims in America?
Well, I reject the term clash of civilizations because I don't think it makes any sense, especially because there is no such thing as Islamic civilization. It's a made-up phrase. It has no definition. I mean, what does it mean? What does Islamic civilization – what are you talking about when you say Islamic civilization? Are you talking about the Arab world, which is, I guess, where Islam came from, but Arabs make up about 10% of the world's 1.5 billion Muslims. Are you talking about Persian civilization? I mean, as an Iranian, I'd like to think that that's what you're talking about, but probably not. Are you talking about Turkish civilization? Are you talking about Mongol civilization? What are you talking about? What you're talking about is Islam. That's what you're talking about. You're not making a civilizational argument. You're making a religious argument. And certainly when you say Western civilization, you are referencing Christian civilization, despite the fact that Christianity is a Middle Eastern religion. But I think what I prefer is the notion of a clash of monotheisms, because that's really what we're referring to here. These three great monotheistic faiths, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, are almost by definition absolutist. I mean, it's only natural, I suppose, that if you believe there's only one God, that you believe that there's only one path to that God, and that all of the paths are incorrect. And so you have always had this problem of a clash between these three great faiths. What we're seeing nowadays, I think, with globalization increasingly erasing the national borders that divide us into nation states, as identities are becoming much more transnational. And in fact, as people are beginning to revert to more tribal forms of identity, ethnicity, religion, kinship. What's happening, I think, is that the separation, the wall between religion and politics, between the secular and the profane, this is sort of the principal ideology of the 20th century, that wall is beginning to crumble. Religion and politics are very much being spoken of in the exact same language. They're using the same metaphors. And as a result, our wars are becoming less politicized and becoming more religionized, if you will. This is sort of the subject of How to Win a Cosmic War, is what happens, you know, when people are beginning to identify themselves primarily in religious terms. What happens when we go to war? Well, those wars become religious wars. The problem with religious wars is they don't end. When what's at stake is your very identity, you cannot surrender. You cannot compromise in that kind of conflict. And that's exactly what we are facing now in the 21st century. So really the problem here is with trying to figure out a way not just to strip these conflicts of their religious connotations, but to create a sense of spirituality that is less absolutist, is more pluralistic, more recognition of the value of the other. And that, I think, is, and perhaps has always been, the principal challenge of the human race.
Let's take another question from the audience. We have two questions that are maybe related. One relates to Keith Ellison. Keith Ellison, the first U.S. congressman who's a Muslim, was elected from Minnesota. One question from the audience is, who are Islam's best allies in the U.S. Congress? And you could address this later. But the other question is, who are two or three Muslim Americans that non-Muslims in the U.S. should learn from to learn more about Muslim Americans? And you might be biased in that sense. You might choose yourself.
Please learn nothing from me, please. Those are very good questions. I know Keith Ellison very well, and I'm an advisor to him on a lot of issues. I think that it's remarkable that it took until the 260th year of our republic for us to get our first Muslim congressman. But great, I'm glad that we did, and I think that, you know, we'll probably have a lot more. Of course, even then, you weren't without controversy. I remember when Keith Ellison, who's African American, for those of you who don't know, appeared right after he won. He appeared on the Glenn Beck show. I try my hardest not to mention Glenn Beck's name because it sort of makes me throw up inside. But Glenn Beck's first question to Congressman Keith Ellison, an African-American man whose ancestors were forced here on slave ships and who built this country from the ground up. The first question by Glenn Beck, a German-American whose parents, I believe, immigrated to this country, was, "Tell us, Mr. Congressman, convince us as to why we should not believe that you are working with our enemies." Now, later on, I advised Keith Ellison that the next time someone asked him that question, he should punch him in the face. But Congressman Ellison took a different tact and answered it in, you know, as political a way as he possibly could. And of course, as you remember, there was all kinds of furor over the fact that he chose to take his oath of office with his hand on a Quran, not a Bible, even though the Quran belonged to Thomas Jefferson. So we've got a long ways to go, you know, a long ways to go before we're comfortable with this. But it's happening, and there's, you know, little that we can do about it. As far as American Muslim heroes, I mean, I'll mention two because I think that in many ways they represent the future of this country. The first is a very good friend of mine, Eboo Patel, Chicagoan founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps. Eboo, who's been praised by President Clinton and many other important dignitaries in the United States for his work, has started a program in which he takes young Muslims, Jews, Christians, Hindus, people from all over the different faiths, and brings them together not for interfaith dialogue. We're in the United States. We're beyond that. But for interfaith action. Not to get together and figure out, you know, what we have in common. Forget about that. Let's get together and let's go clean up downtown Chicago. And it's a brilliant idea, and he's enormously successful. And I encourage everyone to learn more about Interfaith Youth Corps. The other person that I will mention is Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. Sheikh Hamza Yusuf is an American convert to Islam. He is the head of the Zaytuna Institute, which is America's first seminary, Islamic seminary. Hamza figured out something very important. He realized that although you have this progressive, modern, westernized, and young Muslim community in the United States, all their imams are old guys from Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And these are people who have nothing to say to a 20-year-old, you know, Pakistani-American kid, you know, who plays Xbox on the weekends. So what he decided to do was start a seminary in the United States in which he would train Americans to be imams. That has had an enormous impact, and now it's being copied all across Europe. So I think this notion of creating an indigenous idea of Islam, a truly American Islam, is being formed by people all around us. And I think Sheikh Hamza, the Zaytuna Institute, and Eboo Patel at Interfaith Youth Corps are two of the real heroes of that movement.
A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Reza Aslan about Islamic identity in the United States. There's actually, maybe it's controversy with a little c, but there is controversy about actually how many Muslims there are in America. There are some estimates, you mentioned 8 million, I believe. There are some people who say there are really only maybe 1 or 2 million, and because the U.S. Census does not take religion into consideration, it's a debatable question. And I know the question is actually important for a lot of reasons. Is Islam the second biggest religion in America, or isn't it? These other questions that relate to that. How do Muslims and non-Muslims get around that whole idea? Is it 1 million or 8 million? Because that's obviously a big
Yeah, and it has become a point of controversy, you're right. I'm not, you know, part of the census, so I don't really know. I just go by the State Department's numbers. I think that the number is probably between 6 and 8 million. State Department says 8 million. I've heard numbers as large as 10 million, actually. But it's difficult to say. We also have to remember that about, from the numbers that I've seen, about a third of American Muslims are so-called indigenous Muslims, sometimes also referred to as African-American Muslims. And so, you know, it's not just an immigrant community. And that also, I think, confuses aspects in some ways. So I don't know. I'm just going by the State Department, I guess.
This may be a good time to go back in history a little bit. In your a book, I believe it's How to Win a Cosmic War, or maybe No God But God, you talk about Sayyid Qutb from Egypt, who one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood, and how when he was in the United States, this is granted the late 1940s, he was very troubled by what he saw as American superficiality, materialism, and all these other things that in some ways still exist in the minds of people around the world as something they can label Americans, you know, superficial, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, obviously, that comment in itself, I mean, granted, I'm boiling it down to a sentence here, that comment in itself is reflective of how people boil, you know, are superficially looking at the United States. But can you talk about how there is still this sense of America and maybe American Muslims by default as being kind of superficial in a sense? You know, American Muslims are not really getting the real Islamic identity they should be getting that other Muslims are getting around the world.
Oh, yeah, that's a common refrain that you hear a lot, you know, particularly in the Arab world, and it's, by the way, it's not just about American Muslims. It's about European Muslims. It's about Indian Muslims. It's about South Asian Muslims. It's about Southeast Asian Muslims. It's basically, if you're not an Arab, you're not really a Muslim, is a common refrain in the Middle East. So you can't really take it all that seriously, to be honest with you. But I do think that there is something to be said about this notion of the impression that America gives to the rest of the world of our, you know, materialism, our superficiality, as you said. And it is a challenge that we have to deal with, particularly those of us who are in the process of trying to build bridges between the United States and the rest of the globe. And particularly when it comes to the Muslim world. But at the same time, however, I think that we can sort of inflate this issue a little too much, because frankly, when you talk to young Muslims on the streets of Cairo, what they want is that American materialism. What they want is that American lifestyle. And perhaps some of that anger and bitterness has to do with the fact that they don't have it. An enormous amount of the anger and bitterness has to do not with American culture or American society or the American people, but American foreign policy. And they have the kind of sophistication that is often lacking in the United States to differentiate between the American government and the American people. We in the United States tend not to do that. I have a theory about this, by the way. I think primarily it's because in many of these other countries, in Egypt, in Iran, in Syria, what have you, the government does not represent the people. Very few Iranians think that their government actually represents them. Very few Egyptians think that. And so they assume that that can't possibly be the case in the United States either. That if the government is pursuing a particular foreign policy, well, that can't speak for Americans. Whereas we in the United States expect our government to represent us, and we just assume that other people's governments represent them. And so if Iran is doing so-and-so, then that must be how the Iranians feel. But I think that we need to learn a lesson from many of these peoples to make that important differentiation between a culture and a government, between a people and a policy. And I think that sense of person-to-person, or what we call public diplomacy, is really the future for the kind of bridge building that I've been talking about this entire time.
And this differentiation between a government and its people came into focus completely in your native country, Iran. And in a way, you know, the political elections there really brought into focus for a lot of Americans, because this was a very visual coverage, the difference between their extreme religious clerical government and a very liberal, in a way, highly educated people. Now, I know your subject today is Islamic identity in the United States, but, you know, a lot of people have asked questions about Iran. One of them, of course, relates to the election. And the question, take it for what it is, what can we, the folks outside of Iran, do to help the Iranians overthrow the hardliners? Now, that's easier asked. Well, let's hear what you have to say about that.
Well, Rebecca, you know, it depends what you mean by overthrow. Let's start there. If you are looking for a new revolution in Iran, you can stop holding your breath now, because it's not going to happen. If you're looking for dramatic political change, greater democracy, greater freedom and openness in Iran, then that is something that you can actually do to promote. But the way to promote that is through greater dialogue, greater diplomacy between the United States and Iran. The problem with Iran right now is the economy. This is a country in which 70% of the population is under the age of 30, 50% under the age of 25. And it's a country in which the literacy rates just for women alone is at 90%. And indeed, 60% of the college degrees go to women. Incredibly sophisticated, politically and culturally, technologically savvy, globalized, plugged in to the world, as we've seen. And yet it's also a country that has a 26% inflation rate, annual inflation rate, an unofficial unemployment rate that reaches about 40%. This is a country that has been isolated from the outside world for so long that it has allowed the regime to entrench itself in a way that it certainly would not have had an opportunity to do so had it had access to the global market, certainly, and into the international community. You want to change Iran? Stop isolating it. You know, what I always say is that a tyrant stays in power by isolating his people. For 30 years, we have done the tyrant's work for him in Iran. So open that country up. Open it up. Force that country open, whether they like it or not. And you will see a different kind of Iran. Regime change is going to be a very slow, gradual process. It's going to happen, but it's going to be a slow process. It's not going to be a sort of an overnight thing, as some people, I think it might.
Well, and an example of connected cultures, in a way, has happened for many years now, really, because of satellite television. And a lot of Iranians view American-Iranian TV stations. You live in Los Angeles. There are many based there.
That's right.
And, in fact, I imagine that you've probably been on some of these stations. And if you go to Iran, as I was last in 2004, people there are in some ways even more familiar with American culture than a lot of Americans are. Granted, this is a limited a sliver of it. But can you talk about how there is this connection between Iran and Iranian Americans? I mean, there are estimated, a million Iranian Americans in the Los Angeles area.
Yeah, that's right. As we call it, Terangelists, actually. But yes, there are, I think, about 8 or 9 satellite stations. And they're enormously popular in Iran. I've been to villages where I've seen mud huts with satellite dishes. And it doesn't matter whether you're conservative or liberal, whether you're pious or not. The fact is that if you want any kind of Persian language entertainment, you're not going to get it on state television. So you watch it, you know, beaming out of Beverly Hills and out of Westwood. And in that regard, Iranians in Iran appreciate it very much. What they don't appreciate is the propaganda that comes with it. And I spoke to actually the owner of the largest of the satellite stations, who said to me, without any sort of doubt, that his purpose is to entice Iranian youth with what their, you know, fellow Iranians in America, and by which he means Los Angeles, have. And what they have are Bentleys and Lamborghinis. So they show these music videos of Persian pop stars grinding, you know, against each other in steamy nightclubs. And then they follow it up with a quote-unquote news broadcast whose purpose is to get kids in Iran to pour out onto the streets and overturn their government. And when you talk to the kids in Iran, what they say is, thank you so much for the video. Thank you. It's fantastic. I love that song. But as far as the new stuff goes, they look at it with total contempt, if not downright mockery. You know, the idea that some, you know, millionaire living in a palace in Brentwood is going to talk me into coming out onto the streets of Tehran and bringing down my government for him is absurd. So again, the connectivity, of course, is there, but there's a real disconnect when it comes to, you know, the communication value.
A reminder again to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Reza Aslan about Islamic identity in America. You know, you write a lot about Islamic identity, and I assume you've been asked this as well. How devoutly religious are you?
Well, I don't talk about my religious life except to say that I'm a Muslim and that Islam is the language that I find most conducive to the way that I think not just about the divine but about my place in the world.
And I will say this. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of Muslims in America who take the same approach as, you know, let's not get into that per se. Let's talk about other things. And one person I interviewed recently was a man named Dr. Naif Amutawa, who's a Kuwaiti national, lives in New York part of the time. But he has he's created this Islamic superheroes comic book series called The 99. For those of you in the audience, here you can see it here. But it has, you know, like Spider-Man and Batman-like figures, but these are Muslims and non-Muslims banding together to save the world. And it's very nicely done, and it really gives you this sense of Islam in a way that you don't get from reading the hard news articles, watching CNN. It's very popular. I think they sell a million copies of these every month or so. And these actually, he told me there's going to be a TV series.
Yeah,
a la The Simpsons, you know, coming to satellite TV networks around the world, not just the United States, hopefully, but Europe and elsewhere. But so can you talk about that as well, this kind of non-religious side of Islam that does reveal itself in interesting ways?
Well, let's be clear for a moment here. When we talk about religion, and I'm talking about all religions, we are not talking about personal confessions of faith. Rarely is that what we mean when we say, I am a Christian, I am a Jew, I am a Muslim, I'm a Hindu, or whatever. Think about this. The United States is 78% Christian. Now, think about that for a moment. Do you really think that 78% of Americans go to church on Sunday? Do you think that 78% of Americans read the Bible on a regular basis? Do you think that 78% of Americans can tell you anything about the gospel story at all? Of course not. The phrase, I am a Christian in this country, has become synonymous with I am American. The cross and the flag have bled into a single icon. That's how it is everywhere in the world. When you make a statement of faith, you are making a statement that is about your identity. It encompasses your ethnicity, your culture, your nationality, the way you understand the world. And so that's not unique by any means to Islam in America or Islam anywhere else. But if I can get academic for a moment here, I do think that it's important to recognize that, as I mentioned earlier, as nationalism begins to give way to other forms of collective identity, and this is happening already all across the world. We're a little bit late to it in the United States. I always sort of say that we'll be the last nation standing. And primarily that has to do with our history, but it also has to do with the fact that we're an island in the middle of, you know, an ocean here in some ways. And so in much of the world, as religion or ethnicity or tribe or kinship begin to replace nationality as your primary marker of identity, your sense of collective, your sense of society is going to change. It's going to expand because it's no longer limited by geographic borders. And that's been happening primarily throughout Europe. You're seeing the European Union start to really struggle with trying to figure out a way and how do you construct a national identity when your birth certificate says European Union, when you have a single currency, a single passport, a single parliament, a single constitution, 27 nations. How do you construct a distinctly Danish identity in the midst of that? Or does your sense of who you are expand beyond Denmark? And do you think of yourself primarily as European first and Danish second? In the Middle East, you're seeing this a lot with people trying to figure out, should I define myself as culturally Arab or nationally Egyptian or religiously Muslim? So, and again, thanks to the internet, we have the ability to create all these micro communities that have no boundaries and no limitations whatsoever. The reason that the 99 has worked so well is because you have 99 superheroes of different ethnicities, different nationalities, different religions, who are coming together to save the entire planet. So if you're Egyptian, or if you're Indonesian, or if you're Malaysian, or if you're South African, or if you're from Detroit, you can relate to this, because this is, if you're under 30, this is the world you live in anyway. Sorry about you over 30s. A world without borders. A world in which your identity is no longer constrained by territory. That's what's happening to Islam. It's what's happening to most religions. And sooner or later, it's going to be what's happening in the United States as well.
Another question from the audience. In your book, No God But God, you stated, as I recall, that the Quran was never meant to be read as an isolated text but part of a cohesive whole, in other words, informed by a reading of the former books, like the Torah and so forth. What needs to happen, do you suppose, before more Muslims begin to read the Quran in this way, or do more majority of Muslims read the Quran that way anyway?
Yes, the Quran itself constantly says over and over again that this is not a new message. This is the same message that was given to the Jews in the Torah, that was given to the Christians in the Gospels, that their God and your God are the same, that their scriptures are and your scriptures are the same. The Quran sees itself as a continuation of a prophetic tradition that actually starts with Adam, the first human being, and goes straight to Muhammad, the seal of the prophets. So nothing comes after. Which, of course, whenever you're last, you think you're the end. Nothing comes after, but everything that came before is part of the same narrative. And indeed, there is a conception in the Quran called Umm al-Kitab, the mother of books, that says that the Quran itself is just simply one part of a larger divine text in heaven from which all revealed scriptures come. So that connectivity, I think, is very important in understanding the Quran. Why don't more Muslims think that way? Well, there's a very simple reason for this. It's that the same rigorous exegetical work that occurred in the late 19th and early 20th centuries about the Bible, and these are sort of some of my academic heroes who did this work, is totally brand new with the Quran. My cohort, my PhD program, we were amongst the first to take a rigorous, historical, contextual, exegetical approach to the Quran as a piece of literature to be dissected and understood, which is what happened with the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, and certainly with the New Testament over the last century. We are borrowing those tools to create a new understanding of the Quran. So it's a very new process. It's a process that's just sort of getting going. Primarily, it's getting going, of course, in the West. But I think that it will trickle down to the rest of the Muslim world. But it's one that doesn't have a lot of tradition behind it just yet. Very few Muslims think of the Quran as both a historical work and a holy text, whereas you do get that amongst many Jews and Christians. You can be someone who believes that the Gospels are the inerrant, literal word of God and also a historical text to be studied at a university.
I know immediately after 9/11, a lot of Americans flummoxed may be the wrong word here, by what had happened, decided to look at Islam more closely, and sales of the Quran shot up in this country. A lot of non-Muslims reading it for the first time.
That's such a bad idea.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, and so if you read the Quran in a way, say you were to open it up to one page and look at it, I think a lot of people are shocked by what
right.
they see. Granted, people are shocked by the Bible as well if you open it up in other religious texts. But can you talk about that, how it's a
very
mistake for non-Muslims
question,
to look at it that
I mean,
way.
Muslims don't read the Quran from first to last. That's not how the Quran was ever meant to be read. It was deliberately put together without order, without chronology, without theme. It was simply put together by the longest chapters to the shortest chapters, and the chapters themselves are completely randomly put together. They have titles that have nothing to do with what the chapter is about, and this was on purpose because the compilers of the Quran didn't want any kind of human activity to take away from the divine nature of the text. There's no commentary. It's a completely baffling text for someone who's used to reading all these wonderful stories about Jacob blowing his horn or Joshua blowing his horn and walls coming down and you know, dramatic battles. It has nothing to do with Muhammad. Muhammad is not mentioned in the Quran except for a handful of times. It says nothing about the history of Islam whatsoever. It's just simply God talking in random bits. That's it. And so most Muslims, when they read the Quran, they just sort of open it up at random and just begin reading certain verses. But you're right. A lot of people picked up the Quran at Barnes & Noble, and they started at the beginning and read it through as though they were starting at Genesis. If you actually made it to the end, mazel tov. I mean, goodness gracious. But you probably didn't. You probably got confused. What I did notice, however, is a dearth of both, you know, amateurs and so-called experts who basically dissected the Quran for bits of savagery and then used that as an excuse to say, well, this is Islam promoting violence. I'm not even going to respond to that because it's too unsophisticated. It doesn't merit a response except to say, have you read Deuteronomy lately? But all texts, we have to understand, any text that matters, any scripture that matters, talks about war and peace, talks about violence and nonviolence. If it only talks about one of those things, it's an irrelevant text. The reason we read the Torah after 5,000 years is because it still speaks to the modern condition. It talks about everything that you want to, you know, to have talked about. And the same is true of all great religious scriptures. So I think it's important to read the Quran. I think it's important to probably read a book about the Quran. I suggest No God But God. But you know, understand that you're not reading the Bible. It's a different kind of text.
We're down to our last question here, and we'll take a question from the audience. This question has to do with your earlier idea that 50 years from now we'll look back on this period of Muslims in America and maybe laugh or what have you. But this questioner asked, well, I mean, we live, he's talking about California here, we live on the left coast, and what if you venture to the middle and south of the United States, you'll see what this questioner calls pre-Civil War ideals. Can you talk about that very, very briefly, about how we, in a way, we live in a lot different Americas? There's the America of the West Coast, East Coast, and the middle ground, but, you know.
Yeah, I'll talk about that by coming to the rescue of the Midwest and the South, where I've lived both. I lived in Mississippi. I have a home in New Orleans. I lived and taught in Iowa for 3 years. I know the middle of this country, and it is not what you think it is. I was a professor at the University of Iowa when September 11th happened, and I was a professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies, the first full-time professor in the history of the state. And I would go to these conventions and meet my fellow professors at Harvard and Cambridge and at UCLA and Berkeley, and their lives were miserable. They were dealing with purges of departments, arguments about Israel and Palestine, entire departments up in flames in post-September 11th. I was in heaven at the University of Iowa. My introduction to Islam class went from 37 to 250 people. I had, you know, the ear of the governor. I traveled around the state talking to everyone. There is an earnestness, I think, in the middle of this country that comes from feeling a little bit isolated, whereas I'm sorry to say those of us who live on the coast think we already know everything, and so there's nothing to be learned. And so when something like September 11th happens, rather than trying to find out more, we revert to our sense of absolutism and begin fighting each other. So thank God for the middle of this country. Thank God for the South.
Our thanks to Reza Aslan, author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.